Tuesday the 19th. I'm getting ready for tomorrow's interview of Wednesday the 20th with Fred Sitzer. Oops, darn it.
I'm the interviewee.
And this trail's rest in Bozeman, Montana, July the 20th, 2005, interviewing Frederick Sitzer about his World War II experiences. So, Fred, what would you like to tell us? Sit it right there, probably.
I would like to speak of my combat experiences in World War II in Europe, and unfortunately, I also was a prisoner of war for 9 months in Germany, and I'd like to spend a little more time on that, because I think the prisoner of war picture in Europe was really never told. We've heard about the Holocaust, and we've heard about the death march in Bataan with the soldiers caught over in the Philippines, but we really didn't hear all that much about some of the things that happened to World War II prisoners. Prior to the war, I grew up in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, during the Depression period, and my father had a job at Kohler, Wisconsin, and we were not starving to death, but things were pretty tough during those days. And in the early 30s, we weren't thinking about war, we were thinking about survival. And of course, we were hit with the Depression, and the Depression really had a great deal to do with the war as a whole, because the whole world was in a series of depressions all around the country. Regarding combat with the Germans and Japs, it was my desire to join the Marines and go against the Japs, because I was graduating in 41, and of course
this is from high school in 41,
and the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and we had pretty well shaken up at that particular time, and there already was a lot of stuff going on with regard to the U.S. getting involved in the war, but that sort of pushed us in, and there was a great patriotic feeling at that time, and everybody wanted to go. And we had a lot of movies and so on. I remember seeing Sergeant York with our famous Gary Cooper from Bozeman.
Yeah, from Bozeman, World War One. Yeah.
He got me all excited, and we were ready to go. Of course, we were young, and really didn't know what we were getting into, but the fact that we'd been attacked by Japan, and brought the patriotic spirit out in the country as a whole, and it wasn't long before we were involved in the war totally. So I tried to join the Marines, and three of us went to Milwaukee to enlist, and we're all in pretty good shape. I was in better shape than they were, and the Marines didn't take me. They took my two buddies.
Oh, for gosh sakes.
And the reason they didn't take me was because I wasn't American-born. I was born in Germany.
Oh, you were?
And just before our folks came to the United States in 24, they were not admitted, because the quota from Russia at that time was full. And so they had to go back to Germany for a year, and during that period of time I was born.
You were born in 1925.
So,
24. 24, you were born in Germany.
Earlier. I had to disappointedly I couldn't join with them at that time, so I had to wait till I was drafted. And ironically, when I was drafted, they sent me to fight against the Germans. And I was after Japs.
Yeah, you wanted to go the other way.
But I was drafted in 43, and I trained with the 75th Division at Fort Leonard Wood, and we were broken up in the spring of 44, and we were sent overseas as replacements. Mm-hmm. And I was assigned to the 30th Infantry Division, and I was very, very proud to be with that organization, because the 30th was recognized by Schaaf as being the outstanding infantry division in World War II. And there were an awful lot of good infantry divisions in World War II. In fact, we were kind of hit by the German propaganda people, in that we were having so much success in Normandy that they referred to the 30th as Roosevelt's SS troops.
Oh, I'll be darned.
And the nickname of the 30th really was the workhorse of the Western mm-hmm. Front, mm-hmm. and that turned out to be pretty true, because we were in practically every theater of operation that existed. Mm-hmm. But my my combat was restricted to Normandy itself. Our division came in 2 days plus D-Day, mm-hmm. and
that had to be pretty tough.
Yes, it was. We saw a lot of the carnage that had resulted from the actual combat, and the D-Day landing the first day was fairly successful, in that we got into about 8 or 10 miles, mm-hmm. And that stretched all the way from Omaha to Cannes on the mm-hmm. eastern part of France. As far as the invasion was concerned, they had the Americans hit Omaha and Utah Beach, and the Canadians and British and French, and those troops hit Sword, Juneau, and Gold Beaches. Very, very tough fighting. A lot of casualties. I don't think they've ever really got an exact counting. Anywhere as high as 20,000 were killed mm-hmm. sure. on that day. And I know I've gone to the cemetery there at Colville-sur-Mer. I visited about 45 years later. And that's quite a scene to take a look at 10,000 graves lined up. Very touching scene. And I've been back there several times, and every time I go back, it really grabs me.
Is that right? It's really. Well, you must have had some close friends that got lost in that
yes,
period.
Yes, then. Yes. The casualty rate actually through Normandy, which lasted approximately, I'd say close to 45-50 days, we had over 90,000 deaths. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many casualties. Yeah. And if you look at that, we made a big issue about the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. There were 55,000 deaths after 5 years. And here we had that many, over 90,000 in the first 60 days of combat. So I can't give you exact stats on this, but it seemed to me that our division, which division of fighting infantry division is about 10,000. The division mm-hmm. itself is about 15, but you're talking about fighting mm-hmm. companies and units, it was about 10,000. I would say in that period of time we were replaced almost 100%. Mm-hmm. And you'd get to meet people, and the next day they were gone. Mm-hmm. And then you had new guys coming in, and the same thing occurred. We really hadn't, our intelligence really hadn't figured out what was going to happen real well after we hit the beach and cleared it, mm-hmm. because we ran into the hedgerow country, or bocage as they mm-hmm. refer to it over in France. And these were heavy, thick dirt walls that had been maybe begun back in the 11th or 10th century, when the French people divided their land by putting little rows of bushes and separating their fields. And Normandy is basically farm country, so you had hedgerows in just about every 100 yards, and these hedgerows were about 10, 12 feet high, and maybe about the same amount of width in thickness, so that it was very difficult to move forward, because you were the Germans were well dug in. Mm-hmm. They had artillery, and they had tanks that were dug in, and we couldn't really get our heavy stuff in close enough to do us that much good. Our tanks were nil until later in Martin, which I'll get to shortly. So that the fighting was very, very slow and very difficult. Going from the beach to St. Lô is about a 20-30 minute drive by automobile. It took us about 30 days to get from there to mm-hmm. St. Lô because of the hedgerow and the terrific fighting. This was our first attempt at combat, most of the guys mm-hmm. that were in, and we were fighting against some seasoned veteran troops. The Germans had a crack infantry division at 352nd, which had fought at Stalingrad, and they had brought them back and had given them a chance to recover from their struggles out in Stalingrad and so on, and they were a veteran unit. Mm-hmm. And that's who we ran up against until we finally obliterated them at St. Lô. And you had a lot of veteran fighters there that knew what the game was about, and they taught us a lot mm-hmm. of stuff. And so it was tough going, and casualties were a common thing. I can't tell you how many times that the person either in front of me or next to me or behind me mm-hmm. was blown away, and for some reason I'm sitting here talking with you. We're talking about combat. The movies and stuff that you see, they kind of glamorize combat like it's a heroic thing, and it is, of course, in a sense, but it's really not that glamorous. The guys aren't all as macho as you see on the and there isn't a guy alive that he's going through combat that he's not going to say that he wasn't afraid when he was in combat, because when those shells come in and those bullets come in and those mortars and you're getting strafed and so on, that can take care of anybody.
I would think so.
And they had excellent artillery. The German 88 gun was excellent, and they had actually had better weapons than we did. Their automatic weapons were far superior to ours.
Even the automatics.
I was the light 30 machine gunner, and they were air cooled. Mm-hmm. You couldn't really just fire them, because if you kept firing, they would heat up on you. So you had to try to shoot them in bursts of threes. Mm-hmm. So our machine guns are, at least our light 30s, they sound like pop, 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 mm-hmm. and their burp guns were just ripping
through. No,
and their tanks, mm-hmm. of course, the Tigers, they were just like ships, you know.
They were much better than our tanks, weren't they?
They were much superior in firepower, mm-hmm. and they had more metal on them. Mm-hmm. They were heavier than ours, but they were not as quick as our Shermans. Mm-hmm. Our Shermans were much more maneuverable, but the Germans referred to our Shermans as Ranzenleiters. because when they hit, they got hit, they burst into flames.
The flames all over. Yeah, so the crew then didn't have a chance.
How do you ever know? And they had so much armor on them that a lot of the stuff, if you hit it straight on, it would glance off. Mm-hmm. You'd really have to get a side shot so you knock your tracks right out and take care of them like that. And we had the experience when I was captured of being run over by those Tiger Cat tanks at Mortain, and that was probably the most terrifying thing that that I experienced.
I would think so. Were you in a foxhole when they did that?
Oh, yes, yeah. Unfortunately, otherwise you'd flatten out.
Yeah, I would think so. I would be in room underneath.
I'll talk about that a little bit later.
All right.
But what I'm trying to get at is that combat itself was it's hard to describe. You're in a situation where you can't get off the line unless you're shot that badly or you're killed.
Mm-hmm.
You're on there for the till the battle is over.
Sure.
And as I said, I was in combat like about 90 days, and I never got a break.
You didn't get a break in 90 days.
It was very constant fighting. So you're living in a state of constant, not fear, but the possibility of death is always there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to battle the elements. There's such things as rain and mud. Mm-hmm. And there aren't any showers that you can go to clean up.
Mm-hmm.
And you're if you're not moving, you're digging a foxhole because you never know when you're going to be under artillery fire. And the object is to get down as low as you can and out of light of any guns that might be shooting at you or birds mm-hmm. coming in. And of course, things got a little tougher too. The Germans had artillery that they called airbursts. They'd explode above the area of ground, and then the shrapnel and stuff would mm-hmm. come straight down on you. So if you were in any situation for a couple of days, you'd have to try to put a roof over your foxhole, and that wasn't always easy mm-hmm. to do. But we did go through areas where the houses and stuff were knocked down, we'd get doors maybe, and throw them over the top, and then throw dirt on top of that. But most of the time, you weren't tied up that long unless you were in a really tough situation. And of course, in Normandy, the going was slow. So mm-hmm. if you weren't moving, you were in a foxhole, and you stayed there. Mm-hmm. You didn't get out because you didn't walk around and take a look at the countryside. You were getting shot at. And, the other thing was lots of things. You're in that constant deal there where you're going to either get shot or you're going to be hit by artillery or you're going to be hit with mortars. Mortars were tough because you could just hear them going off. It's a coughing sound. And then you knew they were up there, but mm-hmm. you couldn't hear them. Like artillery, you could hear it and you could begin to gauge it pretty well, whether it was mm-hmm. going to come in on you or that it was going to go over.
Mm-hmm.
So you could pretty well tell by the way the sound of the stuff was coming. And I remember my first baptism under artillery. I can't describe that either. All I can think of was it sounded like, shells sounded like fire engines coming in and mm-hmm. then screeching to a halt
mm-hmm.
and then exploding.
Okay.
And of course, you know, when we first came in there, and you're moving forward, and you don't have time to dig,
mm-hmm.
but you do dig pretty quickly, and you do get it at least under the level of the ground to some uh-huh. degree, so you don't protect yourself from shrapnel. I was hit two or three times, basically by mortars, because, mm-hmm. In fact, the first time I got hit was unusual, because we had a bit of a break there, and we were out of our foxholes for a short mm-hmm. time, and suddenly we heard the mortars, and we dove all for the hole at the same
sure.
time. I was the last guy in.
Oh, gosh.
Two guys before me were killed, and I just had a lot of shrapnel
uh-huh.
In my body. unfortunately, it was just slivers. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough to take me off the line.
Didn't take you off the line. So medics patched you right there.
Back out,
I'll
yeah.
be darned.
A lot of things like that happened. Then it seems like we traveled light,
mm-hmm.
and we never really got good meals. We had K-rations and stuff sure. like that. Those K-rations were just boxes of crackers and you wouldn't call it lunch and meat, but you could spread the stuff on crackers and so on, and you had stuff to make coffee. But you weren't lighting any fires in those days to heat up stuff at night. You didn't even have all that much time then. So you were constantly hungry. And occasionally, if you got a break at night, they'd come up and give you some sea rations and stuff like that. But the Germans were very clever, too. When they fell back out of their lines of defense, they would booby-trap their foxholes, or they'd make them as uncomfortable as they could. And one of their tricks was to defecate in the foxhole before they left.
Yeah.
So you'd come diving in, get out of there, and then you'd have that stuff all over
you.
As they say, you couldn't clean your clothes, or when you didn't have time to wash your clothes. So
that stayed with you.
Your body, about as dirty as you can get.
Yes, yeah.
And it gets rains, it gets cold and wet, and you can't get out of your foxhole, and your foxhole's full of water, and you got to stay in there. And then there's the nighttime where you had a lot of patrol action, and we were probing their lines, they were probing ours, and you'd have to rely on the guy that's on duty to protect you.
Mm-hmm.
There's always that chance that they could get through and maybe slit your throat, that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is kind of what it was about. And it's day in and day out. The pressure just doesn't end, and you're constantly you're either killing them or they're killing you. It's not a turkey shoot or anything like that. The Germans were very good at falling back and then reorganizing and counterattacking.
Mm-hmm.
So and early in the war there, we really didn't. We had the superiority in numbers and stuff, but we couldn't get them on the beach because you could only get so many on at a time. That was a limited area there. But and then the other thing was the stench of death is always there. And as I mentioned before, that Normie's farm country, and a lot of cows and stuff were there, and they get shot, and then they get killed, and then they lay there, and they get blown up,
sure.
And bodies, human bodies, are the same way, and they'd lay there for several days, and then they would burst, they turn blue, and then they
It was
burst.
Summertime, so it had to be pretty warm.
Yes, yeah, it was warm, and then you had that stench of death around you all the time. And combat wasn't a bit glamorized at all. Glamorous, it was nothing but chaos, and then you read about planned attacks and stuff like that, and it seemed like they never went right, and things always got messed up, and then you had to make up another plan of attack, and so you're constantly in a state of flux there. Officers are getting knocked off, non-coms are getting knocked off, and other guys are jumping in and taking their spot. So it isn't always you paint the great pictures of the strategies of our generals and so on and so forth. A lot of it fell right down when it came to combat on the enlisted man with the job
sure.
done. And so it was a harrowing experience there. For example, St. Lo, we did finally get to St. Lo, and at St. Lo, they put up a real struggle. They were going to defend at all costs. Hitler was of the Wehrmacht was the German army, and they had some good generals, but Hitler called the shots.
Yeah, that's the understanding.
And his SS troops were the ones that administered the final decision as to what the army should or shouldn't do. Mm-hmm. And so you had some real fanatic stuff there. And we fought some of the German youth SS troops, first SS and so on, and those kids were fanatics.
They were trained to be fanatics.
Trained to be that way. My experience as a PW later on, I saw some of those guys training those kids, and I thought back of my experience as a kid. I grew up in the YMCA, and we were having fun working out the Y and playing ball and having all that fun, and I made a vow then that if I ever got through that thing, I would dedicate my life to serving youth, which I did. I got a chance to go to school through GI Bill, and I went to school in Chicago during Williams College, and I put in 40 years with the YMCA working kids, so it worked out. But that's getting off the track a little bit. At St. Lowell, we decided for the first time to have a coordinated air infantry attack. And in those days, they didn't have the ground communication with planes that they do now. And the way they marked things was they had panels on the ground which designated where the local troops were. They had bright pink panels, you see. And that would designate where we were and then where they were on the other side. So we had 2,000 bombers that were going to come in and come in first and really flatten them out, and then we would move in. The only problem was the wind was blowing the wrong way, and the first wave of bombers hit the target pretty good. But then the wind caught the debris and stuff, the smoke, and it
blew it towards you.
Covered the panels.
Covered the panels.
And each succeeding wave that came in, they were dropping on where they saw the debris. And infantry divisions usually attack with two regiments up and one in reserve. Thank God that day the 117th was in reserve, because they not only wiped out a great deal of their front line, but they also destroyed a lot of our own front line. In fact, we had General McNair there, who was supervising the ground air attack, and he was blown away at St. Lowell. But then they realized what was going on, and they stopped, fortunately. So we resumed the next day. But we had a little better luck the next day. And then we really, really gave them a lot of problems there. And we 30th broke through at St. Lowell, and that opened up what was known as Cobra, which was the breakthrough to head south. And at that point, the Germans did fall back rapidly to regroup. But we thought, our G2 thought that they were really heading back to protect France and have an action there. Meanwhile, breaking through at St. Lowell opened up a corridor then where Patton and his tanks could break through. And so they did break through, and they went down past Mortain, which is where we were headed then. And to keep the pressure on the Germans, they put us in trucks and stuff. And so we went down to Mortain as quickly as we could. It took us about a day or so get in there. But and meanwhile, Patton had gone around and gone down through Avranches and around south of Mortain. We were fighting in the Cherbourg Peninsula. We were fighting in the Cherbourg Peninsula, but there's another peninsula, Brittany Peninsula, which was maybe they had like 200,000 Germans in there too. So we actually, when Patton went through there, he cut off that whole area. So those Germans were trapped in there. And our General Bradley was not aware that they were planning a counterattack. And so we got down there, with our soldiers and small arms fire and so on and so forth. All we had was rifles and maybe grenades and some bazookas and stuff like that. But our artillery and our tanks that were supporting us, we had the 2nd Armored Division where we would crack out to it. And, but they didn't get there until too late. So, also we got down there, it was around midnight, and we really had a lot of area to cover. We'd stretched an area from Mortain to St. Bartholomew, which is where we were at, and to Barrington, which might have been maybe almost a 30-mile radius, sort of an arc there. And when we got down, we got down at midnight, and so we really didn't get a chance to get up our set up our defensive lines and our line of communications and so on and so forth. And around 3-4 in the morning here, we were hearing all these tanks and stuff rattling on the other side, and lo and behold, Hitler had taken all of the armor that was at Caen and then brought it over to break through at Mortain so they could open up a escape route for the Germans coming out of Brittany.
Okay.
And so, of course, the 30th was down there, the only infantry unit down there at that time. And they hit us with 4 or 5 division of tanks. And there's about, I don't know, exact number, 30 or 40 tanks in the division.
Mm-hmm.
And we were at St. Bartholomew. And we had about a, about a 7-day battle there.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, also, we had extremely bad weather the next day. We had fog and rain, and we couldn't get any help from the Air Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And it took about 3 or 4 days before the air really cleared up. And, of course, we were routed in certain areas, but things were so confusing, nobody knew where anybody was, really.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a lot of struggles that were going out on separate units, and it was everybody for himself, pretty much. And that's where I was captured.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an awful lot of things that happened there. We don't have time to discuss everything in detail, but we were being run over by tanks, and these Tigers were coming in over us, and they hit us at night too, and with tracers, you know, you could see what was going on, and then we shoot and see what's going on.
Sure.
You see those babies bouncing off like water, you know.
Anyway,
they overran our position and split us company up pretty well, and we were on our own pretty much for 3 or 4 days before we actually were captured. And we actually ran out of ammo and stuff as well.
That's
we had just so much stuff there, just a matter of time. And there wasn't a lot of friendship between the Germans and the Americans. It started up in the Caen district. The Canadians attacked the first SS unit there, and they didn't have any luck, and they captured a lot of those British kids and then Canadian kids, and then they murdered them.
And
we weren't as friendly either, and we got guys after that.
That's
and there was a lot of stuff that you don't read about,
mm-hmm.
you know, where guys were shooting each other and so on and so forth, because well, you didn't have the coverage in those days that you do now.
No.
And I don't know what they'd do today if on the news reel, if they would have covered that war like they covered here.
Days, yeah.
But anyway, there was a lot of stuff going on, and we really didn't think we had a chance.
Mm-hmm.
We thought they were going to kill us. In fact, they did round us up there in that little area. There were about 20 or 30 of us together there that left in my company there. And they put guns, machine guns on both sides, and we thought they were going to blow us away, but they didn't. And they did interrogate us, and then they took us to Alençon, and from there we went to Paris. But I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. At at Mortain, we did eventually hold. They did not break through. And the Air Corps did come in. And you might have heard about the Filet Gap. Monty and Patton could have closed the Filet Gap, and we would have stopped the whole Western frontier at that time. We had them trapped in there, but they didn't close it because neither wanted them. Neither the two wanted to get together.
Yeah, so a little arrogance on the part of two generals in different countries.
They didn't really want to have that the benefit of sharing something. But there were like 50 to 100,000 guys that were blown to bits in that area. They were trapped in there. But they were able to get maybe another 100 or so out. But that was known as the slaughter at Filet Gap, because the Air Corps had them trapped in there, and we had them surrounded, and there was one of the, you know, and that was one of the worst slaughters of World War II.
One of the tragedies,
right?
It could have been avoided.
And that's where my combat experience ended, and I thought. The war was basically over for us, because I remembered the way we had worked with the prisoners of war that from Africa that came over. We had had them at Fort Leonard Wood, and we would take them out to keep them occupied, more or less, and we fed them, and we gave them a good break. But getting to Germany was a problem now. We went from Alençon to Paris by truck. They put us in trucks after interrogation. But on the way to Paris, we were strafed by our Air Corps. Our Air Corps strafed anything that was on the railroads and on the roads. And of course, there was 51s and 47 were pretty good planes, and when they came down and strafed, they got the job done. So we had the unfortunate experience there of being strafed by our own guys, and a lot of our boys were killed by our own guys who came down. And one of the kids, when they come down, they would stop the trucks, and everybody pile out inside, and then they'd come down to rip through there. And I don't know anymore. I think the 47s were shooting 20 millimeters, and 51s had 50 calibers. When those babies hit you, so anyway, when the guys were done, then they got us back out of the truck, and I grabbed this one kid and I said, "Come on, let's go. We're ready to go." And he didn't move. So I realized he'd been hit, and I turned him over, and he hit across the back of his stomach, and the intestine started hanging out. That's the way it was to getting to Paris. And then Paris was sort of an assembly group. And the only way they could take us to Germany then was by train. And they had these boxcars where they would have, and then it was all kinds of French, Americans, British, whoever was captured. And they would load up those trains, and then they would take them to Germany, but they couldn't move them during the daytime, and they moved them basically at night. Now these boxcars were like, they're not like quite as big as our cars are, they're shorter, and there wasn't any ventilation. They had a little ventilation on each side. Anyway, you put us in these boxcars, and we were in those cars for 30 days. From Paris to Trier, and at that time the French underground was very active, and they were very careful that they couldn't do anything to help us get out. So what they did is they overloaded the cars to begin with. They put maybe 100 guys or so in there, and there was so much room. There was so much room, you could hardly sit down or stand. And this was in the summer now, it was hotter than heck now. And And first couple weeks weren't too bad because we mm-hmm. were still pretty healthy, but they only gave us bread and water. Mm-hmm. And after the first 3 or 4 days, it the guys started to lose their rationale. Mm-hmm. And it's a survival thing.
Now. Sure.
And they wouldn't share the stuff unless they opened up the doors and put some water in and some mm-hmm. bread. And of course, it was the survival of the fittest then. Mm-hmm. The guys wouldn't share. And consequently, nobody got anything. Mm-hmm. And they did move us. The cranes supposedly were marked POWs, but they had done this before, and they had moved equipment, war equipment,
naturally.
Yeah. And the Air Corps knew that.
Yeah.
So they strafed everything that moved. Mm-hmm. And of course, we were strafed any number of times, mm-hmm. and guys were hit, and wounded, and died. Died in the cars, and they wouldn't take them out. And we weren't eating that well, but we had a urinate defecate.
Sure you did.
And you had no place to go. Mm-hmm. And so you were in there for 30 days or something. Mm-hmm. Then they got us to Trier, finally, and so in Trier they decided to march us through the city to show the Germans the type of people they were fighting against. Half starved them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Trier is on the Moselle River, which is wine country. Mm-hmm. And it's not like here where you got mountains, but there's some rolling hills. And they did have a French prisoner of war camp up there. And it must have been maybe a 6 or 8 mile hike, but it was a winding, slow mm-hmm. hill going up. Mm-hmm. And of course, marching us through the streets, they were throwing rocks at us and mm-hmm. spitting at us.
Mm-hmm.
And nailing us with whatever they could, mm-hmm. and pretty humiliating experience.
Oh, yes, that would be.
And then going up to the mile trek or 2-8 mile trek up there, guys would begin to drop, and then you'd want to pick them up and help mm-hmm. you, and they wouldn't let you do it, and they'd bludgeon those guys mm-hmm. right there. So. We got to Trier and we got some water and a little bit of food, and they moved us then in Germany to our first PW camp, which was 7B in Memmingen. And there it was a little easier going because they were comfortable and we got better food, water, and bread and stuff. I'd like to talk a little bit about that experience now if I got time.
Yeah, we've got time. We'll have to, when this comes to the end, we'll have to stop and change it, but we got plenty of time on another tape too.
Good. Okay. At Memmingen, let me explain the situation here as far as the Germans had developed a caste system as far as the prisoner of war camps were concerned. You had camps for officers of the Air Corps who were shot down. Mm-hmm. You had camps for officers, military officers, and then you had camps for the non-com sergeant, mm-hmm. non-coms and so on. And then you had the enlisted men, such as
LZ Dan.
Oh. And the enlisted men were put on work details, Arbeit Kommando, as they called them, maybe mm-hmm. details of 75 to 100 men.
Mm-hmm.
And it was our duty then to go out and work just like all the other displaced persons.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the people who were in these regular PW camps, they would get weekly rations or monthly rations, mm-hmm. Red Cross parcels.
Mm-hmm.
And so on and so forth. So they had pretty decent food, and they were in a situation where they were in a prisoner of war camp, but they weren't restricted to, or they weren't sent out to work. Mm-hmm. You're just locked up. We were Arbeit Kommando, so they put us to work in the cities, just like all the other millions of displaced persons mm-hmm. that worked there. We worked with a lot of guys from the Jewish concentration camps. Those that were able to work.
Sure.
And the healthy ones were out there working just like we were. And we bombed the heck out of Germany, day in and day out. We came over during the daytime. Americans flew over daytime, and the British flew over at nighttime. And in those days, they didn't have the accurate bombing. Yeah, they had lots of terms for carpet, carpet dragging, or what we call it, extermination.
Yeah, just
they just laid it out and whatever word fell, that was it. And they helped with some pretty big stuff sometimes. Mm-hmm. These were blockbusters and stuff. Mm-hmm. And when those babies hit, they just destroyed a whole lot of people and a lot of buildings. So our jobs were to repair as much damage as we could on roads, railroads, buildings that had been burned to the ground, and all against the Red Cross Geneva
Convention.
We had to work in factories where they were making ammunition and so on and so forth, and there wasn't anything we could do about it.
No, you just had to do it.
Had to do it, and we had to get out 6 days a week. They let us rest on Sunday. And we would get up early and come back late. And Germany was hit with a lot of incendiaries.